Welcome to the first Ludlow Piano Festival podcast.
I am exciting.
Joel Baldwin. I'm the co-artistic director of the festival along with Alistair McGower. And I'm also a composer. And today we'll be chatting with a fellow composer and pianist who appeared at last year's Piano Festival. And we'll be coming back this year in May for the upcoming Piano Festival in Ludlow. So welcome and love it.
Hi, Joel. Hi, everyone.
Hello. Hello. Yes, as I said, I'm new to this. This is the first time I've done a podcast, and it's the first time I've used this system. So hopefully we will have no technical glitches. And it's all a good learning experience. But we're thrilled you can be with us, and for the first podcast. Where are you based at the moment? Are you in London? Are you calling in from London?
I am in London, and I wanted to say hello to everyone, and it's such a pleasure to be back in Ludlow. It was my first time last year, in Ludlow, and I thought it was such a beautiful town that and such lovely people as well, everybody there, that I'm so happy to be back. So really excited.
Great. So tell us a bit about you, Anne. It was great to meet you last year and find out a bit about you, but we still only know bits about your upcoming album. So could you tell us a little bit about you and your background and your last couple of albums and the one that you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, where to start? I started my piano journey started when I was 3 years old. My parents had a piano at the house, and apparently I was going to it quite often. And after a while, they thought the earplugs were not enough to protect their hearing, so they thought, let's get her piano lessons. And that really is the beginning of it. And I guess, it's like it's become like a member of my family, a very, very close member of my family. I can't live without it. It's one of those. It's part of you. It really is. So then I went after when I was seven to the conservatoire, the sort of French music school, various ones, then Paris, which was fun, but I have to say not as fun as London, where I went to afterwards. I was at the Royal Academy of Music, and my teacher there was Hamish Milne. What I really loved about London is that when I auditioned, and I said, my ideal evening would be to give a classical concert at 7 p.m. and then to go play in a jazz club later on and just to improvise and see what music I would come up with. Nobody really laughed at me. They actually took it seriously. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Paris, at that time I would come up with something like that and they were like, you're supposed to be a classical musician. But when you're 15, because that's how old I was when I was in Paris, you just don't know what you're going to be as an artist, and you're not just a performer. You're going to be an artist. You're going to have to have a place on stage. Who are you? And they just knew everything that I didn't know about myself. So I have to say that in London, I was, given a lot of freedom to experiment, to take jazz classes, composition, to develop, as an artist.
So this was at the Royal Academy of Music?
Yes, it was, yes. And then later on, I studied musicology and composition at King's College as well.
Oh, great, okay. So the jazz side of things then, has that always been a part of what you've done? Have you performed a lot? Did you perform a lot as a jazz musician in Paris and when you were growing up? And you're from Normandy, is that right? Sort of.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. From Cherbourg. Mm-hmm. Jazz, I studied jazz in Paris, I studied jazz in London. But I have to say, there is a point where you have to make a choice because, days only have 24 hours and you have to have, to find time to sleep eventually. So I did quite a lot of jazz when I was at the academy. It's not what I do professionally anymore, but it informs, my composition. It really, really does. And I have to say, when I started studying jazz in Paris, after doing all these years of classical, it was really odd. It was like a cotton bud. I had like a sort of harmonic cotton bud in my ears. And I went back to Liszt after that and started listening again to all of the harmonies, but in a completely new way, with that jazz approach. And it was like, whoa, what is he doing there? Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's a really useful lens sometimes, especially as a well, I imagine as a pianist as well, but as a composer, you know, I feel if students have a jazz background, but, you know, are also interested in lots of other things, it is quite a useful lens to look at other music through, especially, you know, perhaps, as you say, you know, Liszt and romantic repertoire. You know, you can think about harmony slightly differently, and the relationships and maybe substitutions and extensions and even even improvisation to a certain extent, and the impact that had on, you know, maybe performing pianists like Liszt.
Completely. And it's just a way, as a classical musician, you take, you know, things for granted. You take that music for granted. You take Beethoven's, you know, works for granted, Mozart, you know, Liszt, Chopin, and you don't really really, you know, take the time to listen, study, understand, you know, the piece. What did the composer bring that was new? You know, and with jazz, because actually jazz evolved so quickly throughout the 20th century, well, you suddenly open to experimentation. I mean, the way jazz works is you're not going to do a wrong note. It's just going to be a new harmony. Whereas when you come from classical, you do a wrong note, it's just a wrong note. You know, so that to me was really helpful.
That freedom sort of scares some people. But I think for me as well, as a composer and as a percussionist who played in a lot of jazz bands, as a jazz drummer growing up, I always found that freedom really interesting. And I think if more composers sort of approach, you know, any type of composition with that attitude of, you know, it doesn't matter what you do here, it's where you take it next, which is obviously so much about how jazz works, is you can, you know, it's not really what chord you're playing now, it's what chord that will lead to. And, you know, where you're ending up is more important than where you are now. Exactly. Yeah, it's really interesting to hear that as part of your voice, because I can hear that in your, obviously, you know, the various bits in your album, in the 11th hour especially, I'm thinking, where you've got these lovely sort of jazz harmonies and these sort of quite soulful moments. And obviously it's, you know, it's got lots of references and lots of other voices coming in. But I think that's a really interesting one in your music.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, definitely that particular track, the 11th hour, I mean, it really is, you know, letting free inspiration. And that's one of the things which is really, really interesting when you compose. I mean, I don't know for you, Joel, but for me, I find that, you know, throughout the composition process, you know, you start with an idea. What I tend to do is deconstruct that idea. And then somehow inspiration, you know, takes over. And I find that, you know, where you end up to, it's not necessarily your entire control. You know, yeah. I always find that it's a complete adventure and it's quite exciting. You know, you never know where it leads you, you know. And so that's, again, being open to the experimentation.
And how does that work as a performer? Because I can appreciate that as a composer, as someone who doesn't really get on stage very often anymore. Does that inform the way you go about performance as well? Does it, you know, does that's the destination change?
Of course, because, you know, in a way, you know, all those great jazz musicians, they were performers as well, you know, I mean, completely, in a way, more, I mean, they were all more relaxed, I would say, than a lot of classical musicians, and their approach to live performance. Yeah, it's completely, you know, it's the relation with the audience, you know, just when you go to a jazz concert, they, you know, the soloist would improvise and people, you know, clap at the end of this improvisation. Oh my God, if you were to do that in classical music, you know, clap in between movement, you've done something terrible. But in the end, who cares if that's what people want to do and that's what they feel like? You know, I like that spontaneous relationship with the audience. You know,
yeah.
You
get are we allowed to do that then when you play at the festival in May?
Absolutely do. You can applaud in the middle. You can jump on the seat at the end, you know, that's cool with me, completely
great.
Cool with me. There is no right or wrong. It's a performance, you know?
Yeah, you know, brilliant. Well, tell us more about your upcoming album then, sort of follow on from the 11th hour. What's in store for us?
Yeah, so it's really the follow-up to the 11th hour, and it's going to be a majority of it piano-based with strings, and I'm going to have the lovely Rob Ames back on it, who was already appearing on the 11th hour, a great bunch of musicians. So it's called All of Us, and it's a record which really is, you know, for me, music is a lot about harmony, and it's a way to connect with people. Mm. It's really everything but a selfish process. And I find that we live in an era where we can't really hear each other. you know, there is so much information everywhere that our brain is being pulled from every places and we don't have the energy to listen. And that's the great thing that music does, is that it makes us listen and it makes us, you know, be open to emotions, which, you know, there isn't much out there that does that, you know, in such a direct way. So it's really that work of, you know, finding harmony and, yeah, and conveying this with my fans and audience.
Great. I mean, I found that in the 11th hour as well. It reminds you of the power of music to just slow down time. And your perception of that album is ridiculous. You know, it's at the usual sort of length of listening, but you feel like you've listened to something for so much longer because of the sort of expansiveness of the music and the and how much is going on in the different places you travel to. So I can definitely appreciate that. Looking forward to the new one. When do you expect it to be out and available to?
So we're recording it the first week of May. And then obviously there is going to be quite a bit of editing. So we'll see with the record label. I mean, I would assume something in September.
Great.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So last year you came to the Piano Festival. How did you find out about us? It wasn't me who got in touch with you. I think you maybe already knew Alistair. And so could you tell us about how that came about? And you brought a really interesting program. I admit I don't remember it all, but there was some Sati and some Poulenc. Could you tell us more about what you brought last year and how you came to get in touch with Alistair and the festival?
Yeah, so me and Alistair met some years ago at the Cheltenham Music Festival. It was Sati's anniversary, and so we were both doing a sort of over 2 days performance of the Vexations, which by Erik Satie, which are due to be performed 840 times. I mean, apparently it was Satie's way to get over a breakup. And so I remember doing my shift, if I may say, between 2 and 5 in the morning. I think Alistair was at a much more decent time. But my shift between 2 and 5 of playing the same piece over and over, I remember that I left to play at the festival at 2 a.m., I mean 1:30, and there was this coup going on in Turkey. And we thought they might, Erdogan might be thrown over. And by the time at 5 a.m. when I finished being cramped all over, because actually you end up having cramps from playing the same piece over and over again. Well, the military coup had failed. So that was the next bit of information I remember. But that's how I met lovely Alistair. And then I did a few interviews with him. And, it was a musical match for sure, because he's got that love of Erik Satie. And he looks a bit, in some ways like Erik Satie. So we really, we love talking about Satie. And then he came, over at my house quite a few times to talk further about Erik Satie, to play as well and find, some kind of advice. So, he's it's great. And I'm so, glad he could invite me for this festival the first time last year. Now, last year, what I performed was a mix of French music of my own. So there was some Satie, because Satie was from Normandy, like me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's in my veins. That music is really, really, really in my veins. And also the fact that Satie was so anti-establishment, which, I find we always have that complicated relationship between, as musicians, between the establishment and the creative world. Because we love to hate it, I find. So I was like Satie because of that, and obviously his music. And so I performed Poulenc as well, which I find is such an underrated composer. He had that reputation of being a salon composer. And because of it, I find that he's not programmed as much as he should be. Because in terms of harmony, I mean, his work is just fantastic.
Yeah.
So I was really glad to perform that. And I also did a first of my own arrangement of the Embrace of Cherbourg. Now, I'm from Cherbourg and I love all of Legrand's music. Uh-huh. He's one of the, those composers that write amazing melodies. I mean, now I find that now a lot of film composers don't really write melodies because it's kind of frowned upon, because actually you say too much, you give too much, and the narrative is the film. It's not supposed to be the music. The music is a bit more of a bedding in some ways, of sounds. But actually I love, those great old films from the 1950s, 60s, 70s, like, with great melodies make me dream. They make me dream,
So that was your arrangement, was it?
Yeah, it was, and it worked really well. I mean, I think, you know, I could see from the audience they really, really liked it. So,
Are we going to hear it again?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've been asked, you know, but you know, where is the score? Does it exist and everything? And of course, because it's Michel Legrand Estate, you know, I can't really give away my scores like that. We want to stay legal here. But you know, I love performing it. I mean, I've just performed it a few weeks ago. You know, again, people just love this music. I mean, it's
so. Tell us about that process of arranging something like that. What did you do with the melody? Because I can't remember it entirely, but it wasn't always front and center. So although that melody was crucial to the arrangement, there were some sort of variations and elaborations on it as well. So how did you go about arranging that?
To be fair, I mean, the original, I mean, everybody knows the Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which is, you know, the main tune, which is I Will Wait For You. I mean, that one's been covered by Liza Minnelli and every other, you know, singers. But actually, the whole score of the Umbrellas of Cherbourg is a whole sort of suite. And that's written. I mean, and it does exist out there, the you know, as a recording. And it's just wonderful. So I went about really just, you know, take the original orchestral score and just make it work for piano. I mean, that, you know, and that's the funny thing about Michel Legrand is that in a way we have, I mean, I wouldn't say, because it sounds a bit pompous to say we have a similar background, because he's such a fantastic musician and composer, but he was as good a classical musician as a jazz musician. And I think that, again, you know, is why his music was so resonant at the time, especially, you know, obviously because of Jacques Demy, of all the films that created a new identity for French cinema. I mean, his place is so important. And, you know, it's a bit like Spielberg and John Williams that works so well, you know, and define American cinema. It's the same for the French cinema. But, you know, again, I think it's that will to experiment, to push things further, which is really interesting with Legrand, while still retaining that, yeah, you know, I mean, I would say commercial, but yeah, definitely music that speaks to the heart. You know, it doesn't have much, you know, unnecessary ornaments.
Yeah. So I know that as a result of that piece and your arrangement of it, Alistair was interested in bringing you back to the festival, and we're thrilled that you're coming back. I think you're playing on the Saturday. Is that right? At the 4:30.
Yes, it is. Yes.
So that's going to be focused. I think that program sort of focuses on film music, you know, whether it's sort of piano based film music or not. Are there other arrangements, and what other pieces are you going to be bringing to the festival this year?
Yes. So I'm going to do another arrangement. So I'm doing obviously the Umbrellas of Cherbourg again, and then I'm going to do Cinema Paradiso as well. It's going to be a new arrangement, which is such a brilliant, you know, film music. I mean, this is all that film music should be about, you know, just dream, you know.
Which is Ennio Morricone.
Completely, yeah, and such a fabulous composer.
Incredible. I actually walked down to the aisle to that theme tune, to the love theme.
Did you? Congratulations.
My sister-in-law played it on the cello with a pianist, and it was wonderful. They did a lovely little arrangement of it. But Katie,
was it the Cinema Paradiso or the Good, the Bad and the Ugly?
No, yeah, thanks very much. Katie and I loved the film, and it meant a lot to us. So when we got married, we thought that'd be an appropriate.
Amazing! I didn't know that. That's really cool. But you have to listen to the concert now.
I will. I'll be at everything. Don't worry. I will be there.
But you know, that's one thing about films, you know, which is so interesting, is film doesn't shy away from. I mean, it doesn't judge music. It judges what works and what doesn't. And sometimes you can use juxtaposition in film, you know, that, you know, it's completely different that you have in the film, and the score, you know, that shouldn't fit, but actually that just a juxtaposition makes it completely tick. So it's a lot less judgmental than a lot of the way we produce programs in the classical music world. And also, I mean, they, because of that lack of judgment, it doesn't matter how old or when was that piece composed. I mean, the one piece that I will be performing is a track which was used in The Dark Knight, which is La Pavane pour une infante défunte de Ravel, from Maurice Ravel, just such an absolutely gorgeous piece of music. But just the idea that that was used very recently in The Dark Knight in a club scene, you know, and that juxtaposition, you know, it doesn't scare directors off, you know, in the same way as a lot of people might be scared, you know, in the classical music world to do things differently. And, you know, I wish we want to do this or that. So they're open. And I just really love that, that it doesn't matter who, when, you know, what was it composed? It's just about beautiful and great music.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, we're really looking forward to that. I also remember very fondly speaking with you on stage last year at the festival with Michael Barclay and Ian Skelly about the composition. And I think it was one of those discussions that could have just gone on and on and on. And, you know, there was so much to talk about from all of us and our compositional interests and backgrounds. And I felt like I wanted to hear more about what makes you tick as a composer. So what is it that, you know, sort of gets you, because it sounds like there's a lot of influences and there's kind of a breaking down of barriers that's sort of important to you as both a composer and a performer. But how does that process start and where do you deal with melodies? But I know you do, and they're wonderful, but you don't always, you know, focus in on melody. Sometimes it's harmony, sometimes it's texture, sometimes it's, you know, you're drawing in an awful lot of elements. But where do you start with a composition? Because a lot of people maybe who aren't composers don't really know what it's like to go through that process of building music and making something work over a long span of time. So how do you make it work?
Well, again, I think it's super personal, you know, the way people go about writing music. But for me, it happens in many different ways. It could be, you know, while driving in the car, I've got something that comes up in my mind. I make sure to pull over and record what I have in my mind and then go back to the studio and expand on that. Or I could just be at the piano and, you know, start, you know, a melody or experiencing with chords. And then what I usually do is I go record all that in my door, and I break things apart. I start adding, you know, texture to it, and then I rework that textures in different ways. I add more layers to it, and then I recreate an entire piece basically from what was at the start. So it's a little bit painstaking, but that's just how I love to do it, because that's such an amazing journey. You just don't know where you're going to end. And thing that actually I thought was really interesting about the chat last year, because we all had very different backgrounds. I mean, in terms of, you know, our composition, how we write, and, you know, and being, you know, from different eras and generations. But I think that now, talking about generation, that new one coming up, you know, is going to have to deal with, you know, artificial intelligence. And how is that going to impact the way we write music? And I thought it was a shame that we didn't have time, because it was so many questions and really, really interesting panel. But that is something that, you know, makes me think about our position as composers. Who are we and what are we and where do we fit in, you know, the new world? I'm, you know, some people are really depressed about that because they feel that somehow the machines are going to take over. I don't think like that. You know,
I agree. There is a real uncertainty in certain circles around music, and it's not just where you might expect it in sort of, you know, music for film and commercial music, where, you know, profit margins are really being focused on. It's everywhere, isn't it? That no matter what you're doing, compositionally, you feel like if a machine can produce something similar, then there is, you know, some people might be feeling a little bit redundant. So.
But I don't think that will happen, for example, you know,
no.
Because artificial intelligence does not have a conscience. Yeah. So how you can't, you know, this sort of artistic output, it cannot have it. All you can do is copy something that already exists. And so I think that the interesting thing about artificial intelligence, if anything, is going to, I mean, maybe will work with the artificial intelligence. I mean,
I know some composers who are doing that and researching aspects of that. And it's not something that's interested me as a composer, you know, in terms of process, but, you know, in terms of its implications, I find it very interesting. I've had some interesting conversations about it. Maybe we should have another episode with with a couple of other composers on AI. That'd be really interesting.
Anyway, I'm very excited about it, because I think it's going to push everything to be us to be more productive, and in another way to be, you know, more productive, but in a better way, because, you know, we're going to have to be so much better to be listened to that I think it's going to be a very exciting time for composition.
Yeah. Well, and I, as you said about the process of composition, it's it's such a personal thing.
I mean, how do you go about it? You know, how do you find ideas, Joel? How's the process?
In the last few years, I've been writing sort of, you know, operas and pieces that really focus in on layered narratives, and so there's often a starting point, which is a text or a, an image or an idea. And I have to, I would say most pieces, even if they're not sort of operas or narrative pieces, I still have some sort of narrative in mind. Quite a conventional way of thinking, but I think in terms of the way I layer them up, that's probably something that's maybe a bit more unique to the way I work, and maybe obscure those narratives to a certain extent to create sort of a density and complexity of sound sometimes that's maybe not always heard in sort of, you know, more conventional narrative contexts. But I don't know, it's hard to sort of analyze what my music how my music comes across, but in terms of the process, there's nearly always lots of extra musical elements being fed into them. I've worked with visuals and with dance, and as I've said, I've worked a lot with texts as well, whether it's through song or opera or monodramas and things. So
Don't you find that as a composer, you are the product of your own environment as well? I mean, that, you know, whatever is going on around you really deeply affects you as a composer, because there is a lot of, you know, inward work, I mean, that you're doing as a composer.
Definitely. And it sort of lives, the pieces live with you for a long time, don't they? And you sort of work on it, but it's still, something is still going on in the background when you're going about your daily business. So it's a very complex process, and that's what makes it such an individual process. And that's why I completely agree with you. We've got nothing to fear from AI, but we need to engage with it. And we need to engage with people who are using it in their music as well to find out, you know, how that works. And explore, you know, I think just think exploring the personal process of a composer shows how much goes into creating a piece of music that's much more than just, you know, sort of notes on a page that can be spewed out based on a number of parameters that could be fed into a machine.
Yeah, completely. And as long as your intellectual property is protected as well.
that's another one that we could discuss. Episode 3. Yeah,
exactly. Wow.
This is good. Lots of material we can go on.
To come back to the concert on that Saturday. Yeah. I mean, there another piece which I can't wait to play is probably what is one of the still top pieces on the classical charts in Classic FM, and it was not supposed to be, you know, such a winner. I mean, it was the music from a film called Dangerous Moonlight. Dangerous Moonlight. And the director wanted Rachmaninoff to write it, so they went up to Rachmaninoff, who was in Beverly Hills at the time, and he's just never really answered, and then eventually they understood that he was not interested in the film. So they decided to go for an English composer called Richard Adinsall, who wrote that Warsaw Concerto, and it became one of the most famous, soundtrack ever. I mean, now everybody almost knows that soundtrack is so beautiful, romantic, and expansive, but the film has been slightly forgotten, and the soundtrack has overtaken the memory of it. So that's really a show winner every time. And then I'm doing another one, which is called El Salón Mexico, which was written by Aaron Copland. This was for a film called Fiesta, which in 1947, and it was actually nominated at the Oscars. It was nominated for an Academy Award for the Best Music. And André Previn had recorded that soundtrack. And so it's El Salón Mexico, and it's such a fun piece. I mean, it's completely like being on holidays in Mexico. So if you're in need of sun, come to Ludlow, because you'll find it at my gig. I mean, that
sounds fantastic.
That's so it.
It'll be a tour across the world and into lots of different styles and composers. So yeah, really exciting. Looking forward to it, and thank you very much for joining us today as well. And I think we've got lots to look forward to at the festival. We should remind people when you're performing. It's on the Saturday, which is the 25th of
it
May.
Yes.
That'll be at 4:30. And check the website for tickets, ludlowpianofestival.com. Brilliant. And thanks so much for joining us for the first ever Ludlow Piano Festival podcast. Perhaps we'll have to get you back for another episode in the future if we continue on with these past the festival. But otherwise, we'll see you then.
Yeah, thanks, Joel. I think that was fun. I think it went really well. You've gotten, I'm really looking forward to the next one now, to listen to the next one.
Great. Well, we've got that reminds me, I should probably say who we've got next. We've got Mark Babington and David Owen Norris talking about their programmes for the upcoming festival. Their programmes are both exploring British composers and British piano music, which should be brilliant. And they've got lots of interesting things they want to discuss on the next episode. So that will come out in a couple of weeks' time. And then a couple of weeks after that, just before the festival, we'll have Christina McMaster talking as well about her program and some of the pieces she's bringing. Lots of things coming up, and there'll be more guests, I'm sure, in the future. So thanks for being our very first guest.
Thanks, Joel, and see you in Ludlow.
See you in Ludlow. Cheers, Anne. Bye.
Bye.